This is The Hayes Advantage. I'm Vonnie Quinn, along with Kathleen Hayes. And we want to welcome in now Dave Wilson, the author of The Visual Guide to Financial Markets, with our afternoon market driver. He's focusing on Nike's earnings. It's a stock that's higher today. They were surprising and unsurprising at the same time. Why is that, Dave?
Well, here's the unsurprising part, Bonnie. Nike's earnings for their latest quarter, the fiscal first quarter, beat analyst average estimate in a Bloomberg survey for the ninth straight quarter. Well, the surprise from the world's largest sporting goods maker came in how far the earnings came out ahead. The company had a profit of $1.09 a share, or 21 cents higher than the average projection. Data compiled by Bloomberg shows the gap was the widest in percentage terms in more than a decade. Generally, capital markets analyst Eric Tracy wrote in a report that he sees Nike raising prices and gaining market share at the same time. He cited a 5% price increase in orders for delivery in the next 4 months, or futures orders. Tracy also cited the company's Flyknit technology used to produce shoes with one-piece uppers. Now, Tracy raised his rating on Nike to buy from neutral. The shares are up almost 11%, which is today's best performance by far in the Standard & Poor's 500. They're headed for the biggest one-day advance in a year and a half, and they set a record earlier in the day.
Dave Wilson, just have to ask you more broadly about the stock market today, rebounding from the worst day since July. Boy, this is a Jekyll and Hyde market, isn't it?
Well, one day does not a market make. And, you know, if you think about what we've seen over the past few months, we've been through these kinds of declines, and in each one, the markets really sort of bounce back. I mean, that's why it is that we keep setting records on the Dow Industrials and the Standard & Poor's 500. So, you know, you look all the way back, this is really like the fourth time in 2014 you've been through this sort of a move. It stands to reason that, you know, the first three times it came back, people figure that it'll do it again, and so you get a rebound like today's, which doesn't really make back all the losses, but at least starts in that direction.
Just a quick word on Micron Technology, Dave, because that's a big mover today, too, up 6.5%. What's the impetus there?
Well, it is, and it's another well-received earnings report. I mean, they're in a position to benefit as companies buy new personal computers, because, of course, they make memory chips. They're the biggest U.S. maker of those products, and they go into the PCs, so prices have been going up for their chips, and Micron has been reaping the benefits from that increased price, as well as the increased demand that goes with it.
Dave Wilson, thanks so much. Have a great weekend, Dave. We'll be back with more market drivers, though, on Taking Stock at 2 o'clock Eastern. On to the Bloomberg Forex Brief, brought to you by Nadex. Stopped up by a temporary spike, try Nadex, the binary options exchange. Your trade stays open even if the market spikes against you. Your risk is always capped. Start trading at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Vonnie Quinn, what's up with currencies?
Well, look at this. The euro is trading below $1.27, 126.89, and in fact, Morgan Stanley was talking about this morning, the market being comfortable holding on to shorts given the ECB's endorsement of currency weakness. It's quite obvious now that Mario Draghi is quite happy to talk the euro down, try and reflate that economy just a little bit, as long as nothing else is working. And that is helping the US dollar index's positive momentum. It's up another 0.5% today, 85.61. The commodity block currencies also weaker once again, from the New Zealand dollar to the Aussie dollar to the Canadian dollar, all down more than 0.33%, 0.7% in the case of the New Zealand dollar.
Vonnie Quinn, thanks so much. Now for a look at the world of personal finance, MKM Collins at MKM Collins is back. Peggy Collins, our personal finance correspondent. And Peggy, we have to ask about PIMCO. What are wealth managers saying? Are they as shocked as everybody else?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I've been speaking to advisors, to individual investors, wealthy families, 401k plans all morning. And in general, everyone is surprised by the move by Gross from PIMCO, which he founded and has been the face of for decades, to Janus, which is, you know, certainly not as well known of a firm and you know, really hasn't been attracting a flow of assets like PIMCO has over the past several decades with Bill Gross leading the front. One of the things that advisors certainly have said to me, though, at the same time, is that with the shakeup in leadership over the past year, with Ellerian stepping down as CEO earlier this year, and also another fund manager at PIMCO went on sabbatical at the end of last year from the Unconstrained Fund, there's been a lot of leadership confusion there. So I talked to a wealth advisor this morning who said that she was already completely out, almost completely out of PIMCO mutual funds because they were uncomfortable with the leadership confusion.
Well, I tell you what, Legg Mason is up 4.5% in trading right now, so they may be one of the places benefiting. There will be a crowd round trying to sort of pick off clients, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I think will be interesting is it's important to remember that PIMCO has a ton of assets from institutional managers and from 401k plans. Those assets can be harder to move, right? Companies with 401k choices oftentimes don't have two bond funds. They pick one. And PIMCO's total return fund is the largest fund in 401k plans by assets. So even if employers start to get nervous about the performance of the fund and want to move out of it, it'll take months for that. So 401k investors could end up being a floor for PIMCO in a certain sense. Wow.
And a lot of people referencing today, Peggy, a piece by BlackRock recently about fixing the broken corporate bond market, changing the way it's traded. This is getting a lot more attention. I got a voicemail message from I won't use the name, but someone saying, Kathleen, calling me from his car, listening to the show this morning, that people are missing that this is about liquidity. And he says, Bill Gross may be stepping away from his position and maybe even taking some money out before the difficulties that could surface with the corporate bond market, other parts of the bond market, come to the fore as the Fed starts raising rates at some point.
That's really interesting, Kathleen, because what I took note of this morning early on, just from my own personal reporting experience, was that he's going to lead an unconstrained bond fund at Janus.
Explain that to our listeners.
So that was what kind of made my eyes go wide a little bit, is this has become a buzzword that a lot of people are using and a lot of people are pointing, including BlackRock, to their unconstrained bond funds. And unconstrained really means that the bond fund manager is able to move all over the place in the bond market. It's not necessarily just a corporate bond fund or focused on treasuries. You can really do a lot of different credit type of investments with that fund. Now, that's important for individual investors to understand, to ask questions about before you go diving into an unconstrained fund. Understand what the manager is actually able to do in terms of what types of fixed income investments. But again, it gives the bond manager, like a Bill Gross, lots more flexibility as rates rise and Fed policy changes over the next year or two to go into different types of fixed income investments.
Peggy Collins, we're going to continue this conversation. It is fascinating. You've been on the phones all morning getting different reactions from different investors. I like how you put it that 401k investors could end up being the floor for PIMCO. I've tweeted that out. And, of course, you can follow Margaret Collins on Twitter at MKMCollins. She'll have a story on the Bloomberg in just a few minutes. Margaret Collins is her byline. Of course, we know her as Peggy. This is all to do with the fact that Bill Gross departed PIMCO pretty unexpectedly, those headlines hitting this morning. And we also have a replacement name for him, Dan Iveson, one of the deputy CIOs. We'll get Peggy's reaction on that next.
I'm Kathleen Hayes along with Bonnie Quinn, and this portion of the show is brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. They find exceptional companies best positioned for transformational growth in emerging markets. Explore opportunities in emerging markets at oppenheimerfunds.com.
And we are back. This is the Hayes Advantage. I'm Bonnie Quinn along with Kathleen Hayes, and we're with Peggy Collins, our personal finance reporter here. She's been working on the story all day that Bill Gross has departed Pacific Investment Management Company. So, Peggy, you were mentioning the types of people who will be able to leave if they want to leave, the total return fund, and those who won't. What will it mean for the likes of endowments? Are there many endowments invested with the total return fund, and will they move, or will they trust the next CIO? And I should mention that I said Dan Iveson was going to be the next manager of the fund. That's only according to sources so far.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important, like you said, Vani, to think about who can move money fast. And certainly wealth advisors that I've talked to this morning that are managing individual accounts for people and wealthy families, they have the flexibility to go out as soon as this afternoon in terms of moving money out of PIMCO funds, and particularly those that were managed by Bill Gross. When it comes to endowments, foundations, pension funds, even 401k plans, the decisions to change investment options and move money out of funds and swap in another type of fund to replace one you move out, those take a longer period of time. Most of the time, endowments, foundations, pension funds, they have an investment committee that meets. They have to talk about the decision, and then it takes a bit of time to make a move. It doesn't mean that they won't do it, but I think when we see money move out, if we do today, it will be likely from, you know, traders who can make faster moves and wealth advisors who can put in orders quickly.
But of course, you know, this is, as you alluded to earlier in the conversation, Peggy, this is a pivotal time for the bond market. The Fed did this unprecedented, extraordinary bond buying program, huge balance sheet. It may be selling some of those bonds, number one. Number two, it'll start raising interest rates at some point. And then there's people who are worried about, and look how low the yields are because of the deflationary forces in Europe. But a lot of these wealth managers don't want to be entirely out of bonds, even when it's risky, right? There's so many pension funds, so many people say, no, I need to have some bonds. And so it seems to me right now the management of those funds is more important than ever and trickier.
Absolutely. It's 100% trickier because you have two things happening, as we've talked about before. As you said, Kathleen, not only the changing Fed policy, which is affecting the yields on bonds and the curve, as you mentioned, but also this demographic shift in the country where you have tons of baby boomers retiring who want income, right? So you don't have the flexibility as a wealth advisor or even a pension fund that has to hit targets to pay out income that it's promised to its workers on a monthly basis as they are retiring to go into anything or just to go all into stocks, because you need to make sure that you're going to be able to provide some spending needs for the people that you're covering. So people have been trying to figure out where in the fixed income market they can go to get the coupons they need without getting hit by potentially moving rates.
Is his new fund, Bill Gross's new fund, because we already know what it is, its name, and where it's going to be, it was pretty fast set up. Will it have the same kind of mandate, do you think, as the Total Return Fund, or will it be completely different? Or I should ask you, do you think Bill will stick with the same type of philosophy in his investing?
I think he will likely stick with the same philosophy that he's had and probably talk to investors as he has in the past, sending out letters and communicating his thoughts in the media. But I do think it will be different because he will have a much broader canvas to work with in terms of the type of fixed income assets that he can go into, as opposed to Total Return that may have had some more credit, restrictions on it, or how much he could be in treasuries and government bonds and duration.
So basically, Janus is going to allow him to do anything and lever up as much as he wants.
I don't know exactly what terms they've set on the fund, but an unconstrained bond fund really does mean that you have a lot more flexibility in terms of credit quality and duration and types of bonds.
I don't know if we know much about leverage into that kind of a thing, but it certainly is. I mean, the obvious also. What a boon for Janus. And now, PIMCO has been the big 800-pound gorilla, and everybody wanted to know, agree or not, what PIMCO's doing could move the market, right? Well, you kind of wonder to the extent to which PIMCO has that now. It becomes a much kind of more exciting, competitive market for all these different players.
Yeah, certainly if you're a bond fund manager, this kind of wobbles the big gorilla in the room, right? I mean, it certainly gives you a chance to kind of grab assets at a time when, as you said, Kathleen, people are thinking about and really looking closely at their fixed income choices and options. And not only did PIMCO lose Gross this year, but they lost, L. Arian. They're two big names in the firm. Now, I talked to some advisors this morning who said, you know what, PIMCO manages, close to $2 trillion in assets. So one person leaving doesn't mean everyone's going to bolt the firm, but certainly their two big names have gone.
Yeah, well, they've got some great people. Mark Kiesel, Tony Crescenzi. We could go on and on.
Edison, Dan
great
Edison
name. Great name here. Peggy Collins, personal finance reporter. Thanks so much for joining us today. Keep it right here. Arts and Entertainment in Focus with an explosive new look at what's really happening at the New York Fed.
At Subaru, we like...
This is the Hayes Advantage. I'm Kathleen Hayes along with Vonnie Quinn. And we want to turn now in our Friday afternoon look at the world of what we call arts and entertainment, a very serious topic coming out now from some terrific investigative work by a ProPublica business reporter airing on public radio this weekend, the story. Based on secret recordings from a former New York Fed employee, and what Jake brought out is really stunning for anyone who follows the Fed and Wall Street. Jake Bernstein, welcome to the Hayes Advantage.
No, thank you for having me.
So, tell us a little bit more about how you got on this story. Everybody's been wondering how the New York Fed, how bank regulators could let the banks take on all this risk and leverage and not stop it. Regulators, are they cowed by those that they are working with? You found out some stunning, stunning stuff.
I think this story really begins in 2009 after the financial crisis. It was sort of well known that the Fed had kind of failed to stop the risk that was accumulating in the system in the lead up to the financial crisis. And they knew it as well. They admitted it publicly. And so in 2009, they invited an outside consultant to come in and do a review of their supervision program. And his report, which was initially secret and then was released by the Financial Inquiry Crisis Commission, is an extraordinary document. It shows that the main obstacle to the Fed being able to fulfill its mission of regulating the biggest and most complex banks is its own culture. And it recommended what the Fed should do about this. It said that they needed to go out and hire outspoken expert examiners who, you know, would stand up to their bosses and fight the institutional consensus that existed at the Fed and really follow the leads wherever they needed to go. And they hired a bunch of new examiners, and one of them was this woman named Carmen Segarra. She was hired in late 2011, and she was stationed inside Goldman Sachs. And she started to encounter resistance. She was looking at legal and compliance issues, and she was finding all kinds of problems, she says. And it seemed like the rest of the team, the Fed team at Goldman, was not really excited about that. And so she felt like she needed a record, you know, because they were challenging a lot of the things that she was seeing. And so she started secretly recording, and she secretly recorded about almost 47 hours of meetings and conversations with her colleagues. And then after 7 months on the job, she was fired by the Fed. She says it was because of her examinations and what she was finding at Goldman and their disagreements with that. And they say it was entirely performance-based.
This is completely fascinating, and we'll be able to listen to, This American Life based on it. We'll get the details from you in a moment. You can also read Michael Lewis's article today on the story. Tell us about some of the 47 hours. You listened to all of the tapes, I imagine.
Yes, we did.
What did hear?
The tapes show a lot of the things that were mentioned in this report, almost 3 years earlier. There's a sort of deference to to Goldman that you hear from the regulators. They're afraid of pushing Goldman too much for information. I mean, essentially, it is what some people call regulatory capture.
You know, Jake, let's listen to one little piece of this. It's in a meeting. Carmen's talking about a meeting where a Goldman Sachs employee expressed the view, quote, that once clients are wealthy enough, certain consumer laws don't apply to them. Carmen was in this meeting. Here she is describing her thoughts.
I was shocked. A senior compliance officer from Goldman Sachs saying something like that is a natural red flag. I mean, you definitely want to take a look at what it is that they're doing there.
And that's Carmen Segarra, who is the star of this investigation that Jake Bernstein from ProPublica did, obtaining her secret recordings. And it goes on and on like that, right, Jake? So many instances where they were deferring to the Goldman Sachs bankers, where they would say things like, well, we didn't hear that, or you didn't hear that. You know, and again, I have such faith in I really do have faith in the Fed and the regulators. I think they try hard to do their jobs. But in this case, they just seem like, oh, they were so weak and so spineless.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of good people who work at the New York Fed, and I don't think we should minimize that. And it is an incredibly challenging job. And some of this is I mean, it's not the kind of thing where, you know, bankers are you know, passing over you know, wads of cash in order to have regulators look the other way. It's much more insidious than that. I mean, these people are stationed together in the same bank, and they're friends, and they talk, and it's actually easier, you know, really as a regulator to get information if you're friendly. And it's just that can quickly slide to deference and to, you know, forgetting that you're actually there to police the banks to some extent. That particular anecdote, though, is interesting because she's not saying that their compliance program in this respect is terrible. She's just saying this guy said something that really needs to be followed up on. We need to look at what's going on there. And when she brought that up as a red flag, one of her colleagues said, "You didn't hear that."
Wow. Jake, this is going to set off fireworks, I imagine. Tell us about how she managed to make the recordings, these secret recordings. Did she have help in any way?
No, she went to the spy store here in New York City, and she bought a little recorder, and she put it on her keychain, and she just started switching it on sometimes.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Carmen. You know, I'm thinking of Harry Markopoulos. He wrote his book about trying to go to the SEC. It was the whistleblower that no one would listen to. What's Carmen like? What a dedicated person.
She's certainly a type A person. I mean, she's a real overachiever in the sense that she's very smart. She's got a law degree from Cornell. She went to Harvard. She has a degree from the Sorbonne and Columbia. She speaks four languages. She's very, you know, she's been doing sort of bank compliance related issues for 15 years. She's worked in a number of banks. So she's very dedicated. She's very smart. And she's very direct. She's not someone who has a lot of patience for, frippery necessarily. You know, she's very evidence-based.
Now, she got fired from the Fed. Explain to us the story behind the firing.
Well, it's interesting. There's a disagreement here. I mean, she believes that she was fired because she found sort of serious shortcomings with Goldman's conflicts of interest policy. Specifically, she was looking at the state of their policy at a point in time, which was November 2011. And she really felt, based on the documents that they gave her, that Goldman did not have a policy that was compliant with what the Fed what the Fed's guidance is. And so we have a meeting she recorded where her boss, one of her bosses, tries to get her to change her view. And she refuses. I mean, he spends, almost 40 minutes, saying, why do you have to say this? Why can't you say something different? Why do you have to say this? And he repeats himself again and again. You can hear it on the recordings. It's extraordinary. And she ultimately refuses to change her view, and then the next week she's fired. Now, she believes that she was fired because of what she was finding at Goldman and the fact that she wouldn't sort of buckle under the pressure. They say that she was not fired for that reason, that it had nothing to do with their examination, and it was purely for performance issues.
Jake, we're going to continue the story in a moment. Just very quickly, tell us when this is on. This is American Life.
Sure. I mean, it's on across the country on different stations, but you can find the podcast of it right now on thisamericanlife.org.
We're continuing this conversation with ProPublica's Jake Bernstein, breaking the story. This portion of the Hays Advantage is brought to you by Sector Spider ETFs. Time to consider a stock alternative. Visit sectorspdrs.com or call 1-866-SECTOR-ETF. The secret New York Fed recordings coming up again next. You are listening to The Hays Advantage. I'm Bonnie Quinn, along with Kathleen Hayes, and this portion is brought to you by Macquarie. Macquarie develops customized solutions for corporations and private equity firms. Visit macquarie.com/radio to learn more about their capital markets and advisory services. We're speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for ProPublica, Jake Bernstein. His latest is a story on the New York Fed, and it's a collaboration with This American Life. You'll be able to hear it as a podcast. In fact, it's out already as a podcast, or on This American Life, which broadcasts in New York at 3 p.m. on Saturday, 7 p.m. Sunday, and at other times as well. Just check it out. Jake, you were talking about, Carmen, who made the 47 hours of recordings and how you had been able to listen to them. Who came out of the 47 hours as the major villain here?
I wouldn't really speak in terms of villainy as much as sort of just weakness and sort of borderline. Just the ineffectiveness. What really comes across is just that the New York Fed, is constantly defining its power as in limited a way as possible. I mean, they're just not willing to stand up to the bank. They're not willing to push the bank. In fact, there are people who say, let's not ask the bank too many questions because they might get, they might not give us information, which is extraordinary when you think about it, because you would think that the regulator would be able to demand information and just get it, that would be a question of law. But they seem to be worried about pushing the bank too hard.
Well, and people have talked about this for a long time, and how the fact that if you're in a bank, one of the examiners, one of the overseers, you're stationed inside the bank. So obviously you get to know people. Obviously you probably want to get along with them and have a good relationship with them. But it does speak then to the folly, perhaps, of the regulators now and the Federal Reserve. For example, it was Bill Dudley himself who said recently that one of the reasons he was watching for signs of financial excess that could cause instability in the markets as the Fed keeps the rate low, but don't move too quickly because the Fed has macroprudential tools. They can oversee the banks, right? Make sure they don't take on too much risk. Well, you see something like this, and you go, number one, will they see it? And if they do, in what sense, how is this mechanism supposed to work where the Fed, the other regulators are going to say, oh, boy, no, you're too levered up. It's too risky. Back off, you know?
Exactly. I mean, these banks are so big now and they're so complex that it sort of really raises a question of whether it would even be possible, even if they were crackerjack regulators, which they're clearly not, if it would be possible for them to properly supervise these banks. And I think that's a question that people should have. What's interesting is that the New York Fed now has been beating the drum about the problem that there's a cultural problem on Wall Street and a cultural problem of too much risk taking and things like that. But they're not really talking about or looking at, apparently, their own cultural problems of a weak supervision.
Jake, tell us just a little bit more about how you wrote up the story afterwards, because somebody presents you with 47 hours of a kind of a Watergate type, you know, recording series, and it's very difficult to maybe get to tell that story eventually. Did you manage to speak to many people from inside the Fed? What about inside Goldman Sachs, and how did you put it all together?
It took quite some time, and I was very fortunate to have This American Life as collaborators, because they just did a wonderful job with me in sort of putting all this stuff together. I did speak to a number of former New York Fed examiners, people who had left after Carmen Segarra did, and they sort of confirmed a lot of the things that she was seeing they had also seen and believed was a cultural problem that the Fed still needed to wrestle with. Goldman Sachs and the New York Fed, we went to them. We started going to the New York Fed in July, asking to talk with them, to talk about this stuff, you know, to get their take on how they had progressed since the financial crisis. They even came in and listened to the cuts before the broadcast, but they ultimately decided they just wanted to send a statement.
They sent a statement saying that, in fact, the woman involved had unsuccessfully interviewed for employment at Goldman Sachs. Do you think that changes the recordings in any way, or the sort of the motive behind the recordings?
That was actually Goldman Sachs that sent that statement,
right,
not
exactly.
The New York Fed. But what she says, because we of course we asked her about that, is that she had applied to multiple banks multiple times during that period. That was just sort of customary. When you're on the market, you know, when you're looking for work, and so she doesn't think. I mean, she certainly doesn't. You know. Think that she had any particular animus towards Goldman Sachs.
Well, Jake, quickly, before we let you go, first of all, ProPublica, Jake Bernstein, where people can read your terrific story on this?
Yes, it's at ProPublica.org.
ProPublica.org, and we're going to be listening to it this weekend on This American Life on NPR, is that correct? Jake Bernstein, of course, joining us to talk about this. Thank you so much to him. Quickly, Bonnie, though, let's remind everybody what's happening this Monday.
We are launching in San Francisco. We will have our San Francisco radio station up and running Monday morning bright and early for your San Francisco drive. You can tune in to the Bloomberg Advantage.
There you go. Bonnie Quinn, Kathleen Hayes, we thank you for joining us here today. We look forward not only to our regular listeners joining us, but all of you out there on the West Coast. Keep it right here. Pim Fox coming up right now on Taking Stock on Bloomberg Radio.